we begin the sick nap. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, TC2WGB, and Paul, WS2N. And the three of us together run this thing where we gather the clan and discuss our favorite subject, ham radio. Stand by for a second. My audio sounds a little bit different. I'm trying to figure out why. Maybe it's a change in the machine. The monologue that I give in the beginning for 5 minutes, I know you guys are tired of hearing it by now, but a lot of people who join the TechNet for the first time and they wonder, what is this thing and why should I listen to it? What am I going to get out of it? And so I try to give a little bit of an explanation of that as to also the menu. Over the years, we've evolved and developed a menu where the first hour, I discuss general ham radio questions and answers, powered by John KC2WGB reading the mailbag. Some people who don't yet have their license or don't have the equipment can talk to us directly on the computers. The TechNet is a live, on-air, give and take of information. And there's no guarantee there's going to be 100% accuracy all the time. All engineers, if they're realistic, will recognize the fact that they don't bet 1,000 all the time. Occasionally they make mistakes. And a smart engineer will say, okay, I've made a mistake, I'll laugh at myself and go on from there. And there are other engineers who will defend to the death the fact that whatever they said was absolutely right, and they never made a mistake in their life. I've met a few of those. They lead a very tough life, in my opinion. After the general questions for the first hour and the mailbag that Paul, WS2M, tells us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing these days. Paul is very enthusiastic and very knowledgeable about them. They're recording information for a good fraction of his lifetime. After that, we get into deeper subjects. Some of the subjects I'd like to mention tonight. The old-fashioned standing wave ratio. Do you change the standing wave ratio when you change the length of the transmission line? We've got to be careful about timeouts, as you can tell. Every minute or so, we've got to give an interruption and listen to all four beats, maybe one or two seconds beyond. So, as I said, we change the length of the transmission line, changing the visual arm. You guys probably remember about a year ago how KC2WGB said and I were having a pretty heated discussion on that subject. There is positive change in the length of the cable. Does change the visual. I was positive it does not. And you might ask the question, okay, who's right? If you dig deep enough into the problem, you find that they're both right. Depends on the circumstance. I guess we'll look at that detail later on. Okay. You sign in by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the night. You do not sign in simply because you're listening. After 30 years of the TechNet, this began in 1982. And this is TechNet number 1454 of the series, either 1454 or 55. If you go to the website of KC2WGB, here we go. I gave you the wrong call letters. If you get the call, go to the website of KC2NJI, which is at www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Go to that website, and the last 6.5 years of TechNet are recorded. So therefore, even if you can't listen late enough tonight, which I said typically runs 4 hours these days, starts at 8 o'clock, it usually ends at midnight. It was because the machine gets turned off at midnight, which I've requested. Because there was one particular TechNet where it ran up to 2 o'clock in the morning, 6 solid hours, and those guys, when they get enthusiastic enough, because there's such a thirst for knowledge on this subject among certain individuals, they would go into the sunrises. And I guess when the sun rises, there's new people getting up for the next day, and you can continue the TechNet in theory. By way of the Echo Link and the IRLP connection, you got people in Europe that are waking up, or they've been awake for a long time. Some of them have already come home from work, and they can be signing by way of those extended techniques. And the technique in theory could go around the clock on occasion if there's enough people with enough questions. applying some of that thirst for knowledge because of that lack. Maybe that's part of why the technician has lasted for 30 years. What's your guesses on my part? Okay, so at this time we're going to take check-in. A typical sign-in, let me drop it. A typical sign-in would sound like this. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe and Yen. And Joe is a frequent sign-in, and he's on the trail of a teacher from the street of a particular kind of circuit that failed. So, you can pull this game at this time. So, I'll let you be able to take that.
Do you want to go out?
You're in.
Who we go? Rich and Kevin.
Okay, we got Rich. Anyone else? I'm pretty sure that was Jim. KC2, I think it is. J-I-Z, here we go.
Why?
KC2,
I just want to do a quick report. I don't have anything to say. I just want to let everybody know that 6 weeks ago, Mr. Nova Scotia and Europe. So, as soon as you just want to do that, you should do that.
Yeah, give us a couple of words on that, Barry. When do you think the opening occurred? And you did say Europe, which means across the pond. And I think 6 meters opening across the Atlantic Ocean. There's a little bit on the rear side. Is that true, Barry? Go ahead. Please. did a ground wave, Copo or something like that. So, refresh my memory, I'm pretty sure on one single hop of sporadic E, you can't get to Europe. I think it takes two hops. Pretty similar to get to California. I think it takes two hops. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one, Barry. Into Moondas, get you out of here.
I think the sporadic E cloud is about 300 or 250, somewhere around 300 miles up if I got it right. So if you look at the curve of the Earth, you obviously need a couple of hops to get to Earth.
So one single sporadic E cloud can get you roughly, what, 1,500 miles? So that's the max you can get out of one of them. Barry, go ahead.
That's the best I ever did, yes, about 1,500 miles. I once heard on 2 meters, I know people are going to think I'm imagining, I once heard California on 2 meters, and it was skipped. It had to be skipped. I didn't get a chance to work the guy. I tried and tried, but I lost him. But that was, I think, the peak of my DX on 2. But it's not that I've done it on way, but it's the world, I think. But as far as working it without a satellite or without the moon or something like that, that had to be the best thing yet.
Okay. What's the best DX you've ever had with all modes of propagation on 432, Barry, and 2MB, H2LAW?
I've got to think about that. It's been a long time. You're not talking about satellites or moon bands, though. It has to be modes of propagation. On 432, well, I certainly worked into Ohio a lot of times. Worked out in Florida. I've got to think about it, because I haven't done it in so many years, but it probably worked out in the Midwest, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've worked into Michigan. North Carolina, I think now Ohio for sure. How far west did I go? I think I got to Indiana, Illinois, 432, during extended tropo type thing, forward propagated, temperature scattered, that kind of jazz. And if you got a high enough gain antenna and a low enough noise figure, you'd be amazed occasionally the aurora curtain, aurora propagation, even works as high as 432. I have no doubt that you've heard 2 meters, California. And I bet you a number of people have done it, although it's very, very rare. As you go higher in frequency, the amount of reflection you get from sporadic E or ionosphere decreases. So it gets more and more difficult as you go up in frequency to get long ranges on these things. Okay. So far we've got Rich N2EO. We've got Jim, KD2BHY, Barry signed in. Anyone else that signed in for the technique, can you call it as a name and the word yes right now? K2RAW.
6DT, sir.
No question. Okay, I heard Hal. So, maybe Hal and I are going to extend that conversation about whether or not changing the length of the cable does change the visor. He's positive it does, I'm positive it does not. To a certain degree, there's a way that we can both be right on that one. And maybe Hal's got another question. Anyone else besides? Give your call letters and name right now.
No, we use 2OSR.
And Bob, I presume you really do have a question?
Okay.
Two more of a comment. A question or comment, which you're allowed to have. And one last call. Anyone else that checked into the TechNet? Give me a call letters and name right now.
Name is Jay. Name is Jay. Julie Adamanti. No comment.
Okay, Jay. And one last call. Anyone else to check it? Give me a call letter and name. You're going to have to say that a lot slower. I'm checking you with a question or a comment. It sounds like DDK, but I can't be sure. Go ahead. Okay, that voice is so muffled. Did anybody hear those call letters? I'm afraid to say that your signal is coming through, but the voice is so muffled I almost cannot understand it, I'm sorry to say. But maybe you can make a change between now and the time we get around to you. Rich N2EO. We haven't heard from him in a long time. And I know various radios have been installed in your location where you're in rehabilitation. I know that you're using a handy talkie there for quite a period of time with a defective double female type BNC connector. And so with all the help you've been getting, looks like things are getting better and better radio-wise and maybe help-wise. N2, Echo Oscar, C2LAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, John, and Rich, N2EO. Yeah, I still had a lot of pain. Well, plenty of pain here, so we're doing all right. You know, I'm in the rehab center in Massachusetts. Got a question for you for when I do get to the house and install mainly my big amplifier. You know, in Queens, you look up at the power line, there are four wires. You come out here to Long Island, there are three wires. They use a neutral, a hot, and a hot. And I know one is called a delta, one is called a Y. And in Queens, I was getting just about the right voltage off the secondary, going to the tube. I was running about 4,000 volts. Am I going to have to do anything to change the hookup on that amplifier? You know, that's the one I built with the 288-77 chip, and I don't want to burn them out. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to make some guesses on this one. I'm going to pass it over to the net for people who are more familiar with the LIPR and ConEd power and the distribution system. Many places in the five boroughs of New York City truly have three-phase power. Three-phase power means that each one of the phases are displaced by 120 degrees and any private home, two of those phases, after being fed through two pulsing transformers, two of those phases are brought into the house. And so, although three wires come into the house, if you used an oscilloscope and you measured the phase between the grounding wire and the other two wires coming into the house, you would see 120 degrees of difference between the two. When it comes to most of the counties and many other places where a little bit of the phase is going down the block, each individual house is only connected to one single phase, one single pulsing transformer brings the voltage into your house. And if you study, let me drop. If you studied that particular transformer bringing power to your house, you would realize it has a secondary winding with a center tap. That's what's brought into your house. One single phase, and if you measure with your oscilloscope between the neutral and those two phases, you would find not 120 degrees like you did in your house in the Queens, you'd find 180 degrees. It's really one phase with center tap. The difference between the two is that most likely with the Long Island power, you're going to get a greater amount of voltage when you look at the so-called 220 or 240 volt line, so to speak. Because your two phases on Long Island are 180 degrees apart, even though each one to ground is in the vicinity of 115 or 120 volts, you're going to get the full 240 on Long Island. Whereas in Queens, although each one of them is 115 or 122 to neutral, it's worth 120 degrees instead of 180 degrees.
Well, I don't want to overrun those tubes. They're good for 4,000 volts if you spec them out in the IMAC data sheet at 1 amp. So I'm pulling 4,000 volts at about, I'm pulling about 2.5 amps. I mean, I could pull 4,000 volts at 2 amps, but, you know, I don't know, Dick. I just don't want to overrun anything and burn anything up. Those tubes are not cheap.
Yeah, based on my assumption that LIFR does not readjust the turns ratio of the transformer, the fact that voltage, your two phases coming into the private home are going to be 180 degrees apart on Long Island, as opposed to 120 degrees apart in Queens at your Whitestone house, that's going to make roughly a 13.4% increase. You're going to get 13% more voltage, and let me see what that really means.
Lower, so your input power will remain pretty much constant to spec. the difference proportionally on the filaments on that type of tube is a different ceramic tube as you here. The 8877 is pretty forgiving. The most critical part of that tube is grid drive. Being it's a golden grid and it's very sensitive, that'll watch grid drive. But as far as all these chips, I don't think there'd really be a problem there. Just slip it down so the input power is within the spec you want.
Yeah, that sounds good to help. I think the 8877 is a triode. He's probably running his grounded grid. And you called it grid drive. I agree with those words. Another way of wording it is grid current. In other words, most well-made amplifiers, there'll be a switch position where you can monitor and control grid current. You've got to keep that below a certain number. As the control grid current climbs, the control grid runs hotter. The gold plating that I think you're mentioning on the control grid, you can certainly burn that up. And after that, the tube has less performance. You can actually burn out some of the wires of the control grid. You don't want to do that. So monitoring control grid current is important. A well-designed amplifier will have some kind of a protect circuit that if you exceed a certain amount of grid current, it automatically trips the amplifier out, either removing the drive, removing the V-plus, whatever. Whatever thing I want to say. By far the most dangerous condition on a grounded grid amplifier is to apply any amount of drive to that cathode, any amount of input drive, if the plate voltage is not there. See, what happens when you drive against the cathode is that you're creating a significant amount of RF voltage in your cathode grid. During the time of the cathode is driven negative,
out.
buttons on the so-called 240 line to line. And as such, that's the voltage that changes. Rich, what voltage did you measure line to line in your house in that white zone? That'll give us a little bit of a clue. QPO, RIW. Line to line. Is that in the vicinity of know that the voltage is directly, not as a phaser, but as a simple arithmetic edge. When you've got 180 degrees of phase shift between your red and black wire, as we do on Long Island, if you've measured line to ground, you know it. Is your line to neutral 120 volts? If it is, we simply double that money and it would be 240 for line to line. So is your line to ground in your house around 120? It is in my house. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
Yeah, I usually say that 118, 119, so you can call that before. Same thing at work, but then again, I'm going through. Oh, I'm getting from 13.5 back down to the normal voltage. Actually, we wind up making 440, and then there's another transformer to make you the normal stuff.
Okay, so if I did an average on Long Island, probably wired houses, I'm going to guess that the voltage is normally 118, and now with Long Island power, you have to double that number, and 118 doubled is going to be 30-something. So I'm reasonably sure that Rich is going to be close to 240.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to give you a little
little bit, like 2 minutes of the open view. The IOT is designed to test, but we ran them at 6.25 volts for diminished accuracy, stacking 6.3 volts. When they ran them at the stack, you got maybe, 37, 38 to 40,000 hours out of them before the ignition started to drop off. If you lowered it to 6.05 volts, it would blast it to around 60 to 65,000 hours. So, it's a little bit of difference can go a long way.
Yeah, that's sort of what I expected. So 6.3 volts down to 6.05, 38,000 hours to 65,000 hours, almost double the life of a tube, assuming now that the method of failure was the filament indoor cathode. It turns out that the tubes that have a real cathode with these exotic coatings in the cathode, they've got all kinds of fancy chemistry in there, which is supposed to boil to the surface at a controlled rate. And so the actual temperature you're running the cathode at makes a big difference in what is the maximum emission the tube can give, how fast the stuff boils to the surface, whether or not the right stuff boils to the surface. So in cases where you run the filament too low a voltage, and the wrong chemistry boils to the surface of the cathode at the wrong rate, and you get various kinds of contamination. So you read the specs on your particular tube. Quite often there's, in the case of the exotic high-powered tube, particularly the ceramic tube, there's some pretty exact voltages you're supposed to put the filament on, the filament voltage, if you really want maximum performance and maximum life out of the tube. And a little bit of a trade-off can happen there. So, Rich, looks to me like the first thing you're going to want to do is measure line to line. I'm almost positive in Queens you have in the vicinity of 208. I am believing that you, when you measure line to line in Massachusetts, you're going to see something close to 240. And now you've got to worry about, will the 240 versus 208 give you grief? And it's something that you're going to have to do some further measurements on as I see it. It's not a showstopper, but you've got the technology, you've got the friends. It's 2EO. H2 Rally 7 your signet. Wait for the beeps.
208 is an industrial voltage normally found in factories, not so much in the residential area. Richie, go ahead.
Yeah, very fine, Vito. And the reason for that is factories really run on three phase. Our private homes run on one phase with thinner caps. So there's the 180 degrees versus the 120 degrees of difference between the two phases. So factories quite often really are 208. Private homes on Long Island are very close to 240, 235, I'm going to say, I'll bet you is the average. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Jake and Vito, thank you very much. Everybody else, thank you very much. I'll do some more checking here. I may send an email off to Ameritron because this is a modified AL-1500 with a second tube installed, but still the same factor would apply with upping the voltage and, you know, so let's see what I get from them. And Dick, like I said, what I did was I mounted a metal box to the back of the amplifier, and I put a small variac in there, which I got from surplus sales of the plaster. So, new in the packaging, and this way I control the, I come off the primary and control the secondary going into the transformer, so I can go up and down with the voltage. That allows me to control the voltage very nicely on the filament, because I had read once that in commercial broadcast transmitters, they like to control the filament on the power supply, on the transmitter, because some tubes are quite critical, so I figured I would take a note from that, and I did the same thing here. Anyway, Dick, thank you very much. Turn it back to Ned. This is N2EO.
Yes, I see it, Rich. It was very smart of you to install that variac to be able to adjust the filament voltage on your particular tube. And that way you're treating the tube with tender loving care. Jim was the next guy who signed in, KD2 of PHY. How goes it with you, Jim? And have you had a chance yet to use antennas when you're on 2 meters beyond your rubber duck? In other words, I've been recommending you set up a coaxial antenna that hangs from the ceiling and or build one of those coat hanger wire Yagi-like antennas that were in that website of Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. So back to you, Jim. KD2BHY, KQRLIW in the tech man.
I have one of the antennas at the VHI. I was going to try and use it to pick it apart, and I'm adding a little more ground plane wire. I just want to see if I get better signal with that, just experimenting with it. So I have it on the bench, but it's not currently using it. I used it for the last segment, though, and it really works well. I had a question today about edge insulators. When I was building a 10-meter vertical, I ran out of edge insulators. I had 4, but I needed 5. So what I did was I stripped out the inside of a sink, not a VCR, a tape. I forgot the name right now, but like an audio tape. I used that as an edge insulator, and I took all the metal out of it and took all of the screws out and taped it together, and it worked. I was just wondering, is there a limit to what you can use as an edge insulator? Does it just have to have insulated properties? Or I'm just kind of confused about edge insulators.
Okay, before I approach your topic on edge insulators, are you on your rubber duck right now, Jim, on a quick break? Go ahead. Okay, I heard everything you said because I'm wearing your phone, but your signal was extremely noisy during portions of that transmission, and you almost dropped out as you moved around. And one of the things you got to worry about is that when you hold your handy talkie in the place in the room where you hear the strongest signal on receive, it's not the place where you get the strongest signal to transmit back to the repeater, because the frequencies are slightly different, and you got a lot of miles of difference between the two. So as you moved around, you were almost moving into the transmitter null, even though you may have been located at the receiver peak. So when I pass it back to you, move to a slightly different location when you transmit, and I'll tell you whether that is better or not. Now let me drop for a second. When it comes to egg insulators for HF antennas, you can get away with murder. Everyone's led to believe that that very fancy made porcelain or glass thing called egg insulator has an exotic shape and an exact design. Absolutely not. Guys have used as insulators on antennas a piece of wood with 2 holes in it, a piece of plastic with 2 holes in it, a piece of plastic with the wires wrapped on each end, pieces of plexiglass, pieces of printed circuit board that doesn't have any copper backing to it. Any insulating material that doesn't suck up a whole lot of water in the rain will serve as a so-called egg insulator. And you get very minor differences. Now, it depends on what you're doing with the egg insulator. If it's the insulator in the center of a dipole, as you go from a long distance or a short distance between the 2 sides of your insulator, and whether or not the wires wrap around each other like they do on some eggs, where they fold, you know, one inside the other, so to speak. They don't touch, but they're inside each other. You get a little bit of difference in capacitance. So you get a slight difference in the tuning when you change the egg insulator in the center. When it comes to the tips of a dipole, let me drop. When it comes to the tips of the dipole, where the impedance is extremely high, if you went to an egg insulator that's 1 inch long, and then you went over to an egg insulator that's 6 inches long, quite possibly absolutely nothing would change, particularly if the rest of the support line that's holding the dipole in the tree is a piece of rope, for instance. If the rest of the support line is a piece of wire, you're going to get a little bit of a change, without a doubt. So I have used as egg insulators all kinds of things, printed circuit boards, plexiglass, fiberglass, pieces of PVC pipe, anything that's a good insulator that doesn't suck up water can be used. And so this is one of the places where a crafty hand can look at all kinds of things in the house or in the hardware store. Guarantees you walk up and down the aisles of your hardware store, you're going to find 15 separate things that you as a crafty hand can modify and make into a plastic insulator. Some of those things, you're going to have to cut them up with a piece of the tin snips and drill holes in them, but still, if the raw material, like a chunk of black plastic that's used for your garbage can cover, for instance, you're throwing away a garbage can cover, and that black PVC plastic could make a very good insulator if you cut it up just right and drill holes in it. So you got a lot of leeway on this one, Jim. There's no real magic there. 82BHY to take it. First, give me a brief transmission in a slightly different location. Let me tell you how well we're hearing you. 82BHY for a brief transmission. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Is this better?
Tremendously better. Put a mark on the side of the boat. There's a joke here. Some guys, when they go fishing and they find a real good spot, they put an X on the side of the boat so they can go back to the same spot. Of course, that doesn't work. But put an X on the side of the handy turkey in that location, Jim. K2BHY, K2RIW.
Yeah. I just got one more quick question. This one is long.
I was reading about piezoelectric earphones, and I think I have one, but I'm not sure. How can I tell if it is a piezoelectric earphone? If you happen to have a data sheet that tells you the impedance of the earphone, that's a clue. Because the wire-wound miniature loudspeaker-type earphones usually have a much lower impedance, whereas the piezoelectric ones are much higher. So the spec sheet might give you a hint. If you take it apart and look inside, you know what you're looking at, you can tell. But you got to be a little bit careful here. There are some kinds of earphones, you take them apart, you might do damage. I don't recommend you do that unless you think you're pretty skilled and unless you think you can do things without creating damage. If it really is a piezoelectric crystal and you disturb it, I think you could stop its operation. Let's see if anyone else knows. And by the way, piezoelectric earphones, are they popular these days? I wonder about that. So anybody with any good audio knowledge on this subject, give us your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I think
you're
right.
It looks like nobody else knows. So the impedance data sheet is one clue. An ohm meter is another one. You put your ohm meter on a high scale across a dynamic set of earphones, you'll measure a very small number of ohms. If you had 600 ohm earphones, that means the 600 ohms at 1 kilohertz, you put your ohm meter across that, the connector that plugs into your piece of equipment, you put your ohm meter across it, and you might measure 10 ohms on a so-called 600 ohm. If it's dynamic, if it was piezoelectric, your ohm meter would probably measure something very close to an open circuit, many thousands of ohms. So ohm meter check is probably a pretty good way. And I do recommend you set the ohm meter in the high scale, but we don't put it on the times one scale. Put it on the higher scale to make that measurement. Over to you, Jim. 82BHY, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thanks. I was looking at it here and I was just very confused as to what it was. I think that ohm meter test will really work. Thanks so much for the explanation. Back to me.
And when you get a chance to do the ohm meter check, come back and tell us what you find. Let me drop.
Comments at insulators.
Go ahead, a veto on insulators.
You got a veto.
This is WA2PJ at Vito on Bayshore. If you want to build a very nice insulator, I have built several of them in the plumbing department in the Home Depot. I took inch and a half, inch and three quarter PVC, the white PVC. I